we've obviously had to disable it because it's closed. Because the minute those buttons work, it's not closed anymore. But yeah, it's ready to go.
Other newspapers could also use it. So, for example, when I log in a German city or something, a lot of people log in, and the Spiegel or Frankfurter Allgemeine or something like that uses it for their news.
That's I mean, in the same way they use Twitter or Facebook or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I also think in this country is a possibility that that's another user group of people who might want a white-labelled solution, to be honest, because there's very, you know, technology innovation is really hard for media companies to do. It's not just a skills thing, it's a whole organisational structure thing. So if they can buy something off the shelf, that might be a useful thing as well.
I just, the agile thing's quite interesting, and I'll add a personal experience. We did the same with Help Me Investigate, where it took us 12 weeks.
It's quite scary, isn't it?
It is, but it's really liberating, and I think the most interesting thing is not those 12 weeks leading up to launch, but actually after launch and watching how people use the platform and being prepared for that. And I wondered if you'd say talk a bit about how you intend to respond to how users use it, because you've said you're waiting to see how people use it rather than impose a particular structure on it.
I mean, we've got a Google group set up, and obviously I personally know quite a few of them because they're invited people, and so we're getting a lot of feedback, not just bugs, which you'd expect to have some bugs at this point in the project, but what incentivizes people to use things like this? It's the old Google Plus. That's the big question for me. What's going to incentivize people to carry on using it? It's great, they all come in and go, ooh, exciting. But what will bring them back and back and back? You know, how can it actually be really useful? So it's trying to understand their motivations in wanting something like this. Some of it could be around cost, but mostly, most of the people that want to use this will want to ensure that the connection they have with people is local. They could easily put, Google AdScene adverts up and get, great analytics on how many people hit their site. But that doesn't really give them any kind of community engagement or any knowledge about their local audience. So this really is for people who want to interact on a local basis and want to understand that interaction. You know, it's not kind of a one-hit thing, it's a real long-term thing, if you like, from that point of view.
I wonder, one of the things I'm going to be expecting you all to do in the next week or two is to be, launching something to start playing with platforms. And for example, for your Frankfurt market thing, I wonder whether this is a platform that you might consider.
Yeah, I mean, if any of you want to use it for a project, that'd be brilliant. You're in. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That would be really interesting.
Are you going to make this public at any time?
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, we've only had people in there using it for the past week, and we're already starting to get a bit frustrated. So, it's not supposed to be going live this year, but I think it would drive us mad if we can't. So that's going to be my feedback at the end of this week anyway, because people are just kind of like wanting to, it's a bit false, and because it doesn't integrate with your other social networks, so it's an effort to use it for that reason. It's a bit like Google Plus didn't really integrate very quickly, did it, with all the it's a hard one to weigh up, because you don't want to let loads of people at it and then it goes a bit wrong and there's something we didn't think through properly. But then for the people that are using it, it can get frustrating quickly. So it's a bit of a balance.
So other than this model, how easy is it for a big corporation to act locally?
Anybody can add news and information for other people to see. That's fine. So just, like Twitter and Facebook, any any organisation could do it, any individual could do it. Are you thinking more in terms of an organisation wanting to use the technology of it?
No, I've heard that big corporations like your, like Guardian, they find it difficult to act locally, to act in an environment like a hyperlocal.
Yes.
They can only act in broad terms,
yes,
in broad local areas.
Terms,
but
yeah,
is that testimony to that? Because this is a fantastic model in the technology. But does it testify to the fact that you can't really put boots on the ground?
I suppose it's I don't know, boots on the ground, but it's being run as a an answer to a separate problem, if you like. It's not trying to answer a publisher's need to go local, because obviously the Guardian's aims and aspirations are very global. So I don't think it's not there to answer needs, particularly for that organisation. It's there to try something new and innovate in a new space. Guardian's great what it does, but you know, it needs other things to support it going forward, so we're experimenting basically. This is the experimental sort of start of stuff rather than propping up with the other.
More questions? Mm-hmm. What about, I mean, moving onto a previous project you were involved in, Guardian Local, is it worth talking a bit about how you, or how the Guardian as an organisation arrived at the point of doing that, and how you prepared to launch a local news website, as a lot of these
that was
doing.
A very different process, because Guardian Local wasn't a standalone sort of startup operation. It was part of the main organisation, and it was a pilot experiment to see whether the local news sphere could be tackled in a slightly different way. But it was always part of the main organisation. The URLs were guardian.co.uk/Leeds was one of the cities. You know, it was very much part of the home, if you like. So that presents its own different challenges, because you are bound by certain editorial guidelines and practices and structures. So very, very different approach. As I say, it actually took a year to get that to launch. Partly identifying how it would work, things like I mentioned, like the sort of democratic deficit and things. What sort of people do you recruit for this job? There's one person in each city. You know, we didn't have an army of people, we had one person in each city. What sort of people do you need? How do you ensure they've got the skills that you want them to have? The role that we ended up with was very much a kind of mix between a journalist, somebody who's into social media, and they had to be kind of a good, fairly gregarious sort of personality to cope with it as well. It's not that easy to find three people who are ready to go like that. You know, we did some bespoke training to help them with that. And, you know, they had to really hit the ground running, make great contacts in the cities they operated in, and build those networks very quickly. It was a very challenging job for them. We had other things in the sort of run-up to it were, you know, how do you set up in a city? We didn't have any offices. You know, what happens if we want to interview somebody? Where are we going to take them? What sort of equipment do you use? You know, we have nothing. So you start from scratch and have to work through all those things. What we did, like with equipment, was basically wanted to make everybody as mobile as possible. So it had mobile phone, flip-type camera, it's actually a Kodak, but you know, that sort of idea, an audio recorder, and a laptop, and that was it. And so we didn't have any offices, so they worked wherever they wished, which was coffee shops, their own home, the local council, the library. they actually went to the people they needed to see a lot more than a lot of reporters do now, because we didn't have much choice because we didn't have an office, so they had to go somewhere to go and talk to people, so more often than not, they'd get out and about. So it was a very hands-on type of reporting that I know a lot of journalists kind of miss that. I know, you know, that you sat at a desk and got lots of press releases coming in, so I found it very liberating to do that, I have to say. But yeah, it's starting from the point of zero and trying to think about what tools you need, what people you need, what resource you need in order to achieve something is a great way of doing it, rather than having an organisation that you've got to try and shift around to do what you needed to do. You know, we needed them to do quick updates, you know, several times a day. We needed them to engage with people on social media platforms. What we really didn't need them to do was fill column inches. We had no print product to worry about. So in that way, it was very liberating.
Any questions about that particular project?
Or for your own project, any advice you would seek on that front?
What topics are popular in small localities, like towns?
If you want a real generalisation, do transport. Yeah, everybody's interested in transport, in their local transport system. You know, you can't fail if you've got the things about transport, because it's one of those things that unifies people. People are interested in local decision making, they really are, but I think that things have whittled away to such an extent they feel a bit powerless about it, and traditionally, I don't know, it's been a bit of a dull kind of area. But if you present it in the right way, and I mean your project with Help Me Investigate is, you know, another approach to that. You know, people are genuinely interested in local decision making. I'll give you an example of a local project, a local kind of website that operates in a place called Kington, Kington Blackboard it's called. And two people there decided they wanted to set up a website because they were fed up with the town council. And the town council for 10 years had been entirely consisted of co-opted members. Those are people like, yeah, I say to you, do you want to be on the council? Okay, sign it off, you know. Nobody turned out to the elections. They just had their little sort of group of friends, basically, running the council. And the local council decided that they didn't want to fund the Christmas lights 1 year. So that was it. That was the sort of touch point where people go, well, we like our Christmas lights. The traders want the Christmas lights, bring people in. So they started this website and literally just keeping an eye on what decisions were made at the council. But they did it in a kind of refreshing way because there wasn't any other kind of people putting that attention to it. Doing it online, doing it very openly. This caused a big sort of hoo-ha, as you can imagine, in the town, but has since resulted in the local elections having every councillor elected. And I think that's quite remarkable, really, just for that simple activity of going to look, they actually changed the constitution of the local decision-making process. So, and there's quite a few examples of that, and you know they're kind of small and they're local to those areas, and unless you kind of go looking for them, you probably won't know about them. But they do make a real difference in those communities.
Apparently, dog poo is very
dog poo's not on,
yeah, dog poo.
Transport dog poo.
Sarah's going to have to go in about 5 minutes, so. So get your questions in now while you can. I'll just, while everyone's thinking about that, I'll just try to briefly describe what everyone's project is. So Seeley's doing Handsworth in Birmingham, so hyperlocal blogging. Tina is looking at a kind of Chinese media industry and British media industry, possibly something around academics and media workers. Raghav, yours was...
It's about Indian students in
Birmingham. Oh, it was Indian students in Birmingham. Jan, Franzi, and Cheryl, who's there in my blind spot, is the Frankfurt Market. Sorry, Rita, you're Cheryl, sorry. Cheryl was, you were something around music, wasn't it? These two have only just started this week. And Bimi was domestic violence, wasn't it, in Nigeria and the UK, probably globally. Yeah. So now I've bought you a bit of time to think of a question. Yeah. Or Sarah, if you have any ideas for any of us, any questions about your particular projects or advice that Sarah would give? Or if Harry and Orwin, if you've come up with any ideas yet as well.
You want a sort of global reach on that subject? Gosh, it's quite a lengthy topic, isn't it?
Yeah,
but I mean, are you kind of looking at it from the point of view of legal processes in different countries, or more from a victim sort of experience?
Well, I wasn't thinking, well, globally, yeah, but not quite, because I was thinking just in the UK and
yeah.
Nigeria. And yes, legally, I mean, it's got legal backing. Yes, that definitely.
Bimi's from a legal background,
I think that would be, you know, a fascinating start for that for me would be to take an aspect of the legislation, I don't know, sentencing, typical average sentencing in a country for domestic violence, and simply map it. That would be quite a telling thing to, you know, to start with, and start, then you start sort of framing the whole question, you know, is it a sentencing thing, or how many people actually get to court, or what happens to the people after? You could and then start building it out.
Yeah, I'm thinking that's good, but I was actually thinking, you know, Nigeria, it's a very patriarchal society. And
yeah.
So it's mostly about men when it comes to this, and the Nigerian laws have very few, there are very few Nigerian laws that back women up when it comes to, you know, domestic violence.
Right.
And here, I'm made to understand that women have rights and they can really easily speak up for themselves. But
yeah.
Because Nigeria is very,
yes.
It's mostly about the men when it comes to these things, it's hard for women to speak out. So I'm thinking, okay, they're both on two different faces, and here it's about women not being able to speak, and here women can speak. So, you know, like a sense of point where I can merge these things together and talk about both of them.
I'm just thinking, given the map's an interesting point, because we've been talking about content today and the fact that as journalists now they have to choose the medium they're going to tell the story
right, okay.
in, the platform they're going to tell it on, and the timing depending on consumption. I wonder if it's worth you talking a bit about how you and people that you've worked with make those decisions about how to tell stories now. They're not automatically using text or.
Yeah, I mean, some things just lend themselves to certain things. So if you've got a huge geography, you know, global project, then, you know, maps obviously lend themselves to that. I think another interesting way of looking at things that we're starting to see a bit more of now is the visualising the numbers. You know, numbers don't have to be just big long lists of things anymore. You know, you can actually use tools, I'm sure you'll be using these later, but things like Many Eyes, to actually create graphical representations of figures. And sometimes you can put, a database that you'd think, well, doesn't, you know, nothing really shouts out to you until you visualise it. And it can make a dramatic difference to the way you approach a story, just by looking at the raw numbers of things. I think that's a growing, interesting thing. Obviously, you know, there are ways of visualising the story, but I mean, there is still, you know, there's still plenty of worth to be had out of a piece of beautiful writing about a story. You know, don't get too sidetracked into thinking it has to be in some other format. You know, the obvious example being things with pictures. You know, if you've got really good photography, use it. And I think that's how the decisions really are made. You have to look at what you've got that's dramatic. If you've got a kind of mobile phone picture and it's all right, you're going to have to find a more dramatic way of displaying the picture to make it make sense to people. So assess what you've got and then assess what you'd really like it to be and what you need to get there.
I'm conscious that Sarah has a train to catch, so I think we'll have a gentle round of applause and a thank you for Sarah.
Thank you.